Hello there. Today is Tuesday, November 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the death toll rises in California as violent wildfires continue to rage.
The number one goal is just to get everybody out of its way. Try to save what you can save.
A weekend of remembrance on the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Monday was a deadly day in Gaza between the Israelis and Palestinians. Also ahead, the man who revolutionized the comic book and helped make billions for Hollywood has died. It's all on today's International Edition. 31 people are known dead and more than 200 others missing in continuing monster California wildfires. AP correspondent Rita Foley reports.
This is truly a tragedy.
Governor Jerry Brown says you can blame climate change for this.
A certain amount of dryness in the vegetation, in the soil, in the air. Then the winds get up 50, 60 miles an hour. This is what happens.
A massive wall of fire.
Kathy Fallon lives in devastated Paradise, California.
I just grabbed the hose and started spraying down the barn.
Paradise was wiped off the map, in the words of one fire official. I'm Rita Foley.
The American Red Cross is playing an integral role in supporting the thousands of residents impacted by these fires. Joining us now from Northern California near the Camp Fire in Paradise is Red Cross Communications Officer Michael DeVaupierre.
We have dozens and dozens of volunteers on site. We have community partners there providing a safe place for people to stay. There's warm meals being served. There's supplies. There's different organizations there present, community and government partners, doing everything we can to help these residents who've been just absolutely devastated by these wildfires.
Are these people that have actually lost everything, that have lost their homes, or are they just displaced, or is it a variety of reasons why they're at the shelters?
It's all of the above. I've spoken to a lot of people who've lost everything and approach people to talk to them, see how they're doing, and they'll just open up. And you can tell they're holding back tears when they're explaining how they had to evacuate their home within minutes, gathered their belongings, their pets, and put them into their vehicle and just drove for their lives. The stories are harrowing, heartbreaking, showing me photos of their homes on fire or of what remains of their home. Mm. So you have a lot of people who have lost everything. You also have people who don't know if there's anything to go back to. Mm. And there's people worried about loved ones. So not only are they dealing with the loss of their home, they're dealing with the anxiety of not knowing if their loved one is alive. So the Red Cross, the community, local and national organizations are doing everything we can, everything they can to support these residents. They're going to have a long, difficult recovery.
When you were talking about the people not knowing where some of their loved ones are, is that because there are still people missing, or is it because communications are not available?
There's still people missing. I don't have the specific numbers of missing people, but at the shelter, at the entrance of the shelter that I was talking about at the Butte County Fairgrounds in Gridley, there's a big bulletin board with postings of individual that is looking for a loved one, phone number, message of love, message of hope, and it's heartbreaking.
Mm. How long do you expect people will need to be staying in Red Cross shelters, and how long does the Red Cross plan on being there?
The Red Cross is going to be here for as long as we need to. The Red Cross is present here locally. We've respond to disasters here on a daily basis, but we are here supporting the residents. Right now, the focus is on addressing the emergency needs, safe shelter, working with partners to provide food, supplies. We have trained volunteers to help provide emotional support. We have Red Cross nurses providing health support. So it's really right now, it's addressing the emergency needs and doing so in these emergency shelters for as long as we need to. We have across the state of California, there are 18 Red Cross and community-managed shelters, providing safe shelter to about 2,100 people. At a lot of these locations, people are seeking overnight shelter, but there's a lot of people who may not necessarily need overnight shelter who are coming into these Red Cross locations to get a meal, to get some information, to talk with a Red Cross worker. So although there's 2,100 people who found safe shelter overnight at these locations, there's a lot more people who are taking advantages of the services that are available and the information that's available. Moving forward, this is going to be a long-term operation. Right now, we're in the emergency phase. It will transition to a recovery phase. So our assistance will move from emergency shelter to casework, working with people to connect them to the whole host of community resources that will be available. And actually, in between the two, there will be a time where we're going to be accompanying residents as they go back into their communities to pick up the pieces to see if their homes are still there. The Red Cross workers will accompany them. We'll be providing them with emergency supplies, cleanup supplies. We'll be going into these communities providing food. There are hundreds of Red Cross volunteers who have come into these communities to offer all these different types of support.
I would imagine some of the support would need to be just emotional support.
The emotional component is huge, especially when you're dealing with loss of life, large-scale loss of property. That's why we have volunteers here to address those emotional needs. We have a team of specialized, trained volunteers. They're called mental health volunteers. These are mental health professionals who are trained and have extensive experience dealing with trauma. Right now, they're at the shelters. In the days to come, they're going to be accompanying these families, these residents, into these communities, because that's going to be a very difficult moment for the residents of Paradise and the surrounding area.
My understanding is there's nothing left of Paradise. How do they go back to a community where there is literally nothing left?
There's very little left, but at the same time, people will be going in to see what is left, to help pick through the remains of their home. There are some homes, I have heard, that are still standing. A gentleman that I spoke to who himself lost his home. He said several homes on his street completely destroyed, and then every couple homes you'd see a home standing without any damage at all. But yes, the majority of the structures, the buildings have been lost in the town of Paradise. I would also add the Red Cross has a resource called Safe and Well. It's an online resource for people to list themselves as safe. It also allows people to search for loved ones. We have Red Cross volunteers in the shelters that help people access it.
That's Red Cross Communications Officer Michael Devoux-Pierre, thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Russia says the Taliban and U.S. officials held 10 secret meetings in Doha. Amnesty International strips Aung San Suu Kyi of an honor over the Rohingya abuses. Palestinians fire rockets and Israel responds with airstrikes. More Muslims are running and winning in U.S. elections. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Palestinian militants bombarded Israel with dozens of rockets and mortar shells Monday while Israeli warplanes struck targets throughout the Gaza Strip in what appeared to be the most intense exchange of fire since a 2014 war. Palestinian officials said at least three people, including two militants, were killed by Israeli fire and nine were wounded, and an Israeli airstrike destroying the ruling Hamas group's TV station. Early Tuesday, Israel media also reported that a man was found dead under the rubble of a building in the southern coastal city of Ashkelon, hit by Gaza rockets. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Michael Fishback, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia, why this is happening now.
From my perspective, it is a bit strange. There have been talks going on for some time, as usual, with Egyptian involvement that would result in some sort of extension or semi-permanent ceasefire between Palestinian forces, largely Hamas, but also smaller groups like Islamic Jihad and Israel. Those talks have coincided with Israel allowing in shipments of money and some food paid for by the government of Qatar into the Gaza Strip. So many had seen, myself included, some forward movement on some kind of solution to the constant fear of war. So it's somewhat perplexing, this Israeli raid of 2 or 3 days ago, which we still don't really know exactly what it was about. Israel has said they were not attempting to kidnap a senior Hamas official, but we do know that somehow a civilian car was used, whether it came across Israel's border, the Israelis allowed it in, we're not sure, but a civilian car carrying Israeli troops, something according to the Israelis apparently went wrong, and seven Palestinians, including a senior Hamas official, were killed, and an Israeli officer, very high-level lieutenant colonel, was killed. That prompted some Palestinian forces to fire, some reports, maybe two dozen missiles into Israel. And then, of course, today, Israel responded in in force. The Palestinians launched hundreds of missiles and mortar rounds. At least one Israeli has been killed, several seriously injured. So it seems, as some are reporting, that each side now has to play to its base, showing that it's tough, that will respond with fire with fire. But talks brokered by the Egyptians continue to go on to try to not only calm the situation, but perhaps return it. So in the wake of what was seemingly a lot of progress, it is a little surprising to me that Israel chose that moment to launch some sort of attack that, whatever its real motives are, was certainly going to be seen by Hamas as a dangerous escalation.
Egypt told Israel Monday it needs to stop an escalation of violence in Gaza. What do they mean?
Well, what they mean is a fear that the Netanyahu government will reinvade Gaza with ground forces and or launch an immense aerial bombardment. There have been three such Gaza wars since 2008, each of them wreaking considerable destruction in Gaza, which is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. Probably between a third and one half of all the people in Gaza are children, which means that one could basically stand blindfolded and throw a rock in Gaza, and chances are you're going to hit a child. So any kind of escalation has the possibility of immense civilian casualties. And this is coming on top of what is already a weekly routine of Israeli snipers shooting at protesters at the fence between Gaza and Israel. And beyond simply the question of civilian casualties and destruction to buildings is the fact that the UN itself has said that Gaza will practically be uninhabitable within the next 7 to 10 years, just drinking water alone. So it's an area already on the brink of humanitarian disaster, and a war would dramatically worsen that kind of situation. So that's clearly what the Egyptians have in mind.
All right, that is Michael Fishback. He is a history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. President Donald Trump declared after his historic summit in June that with President Kim Jong-un in North Korea that there was no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. But a report based on satellite imagery shows the complexity posed by an extensive network of weapons facilities that the U.S. wants to neutralize. A report from the Center for Strategic and International Studies has identified at least 13 secret facilities used to produce missiles and related technology. Although the sites are not launch facilities, the authors of the report say they're hidden and illustrate the scope of the North's weapons program and the country's determination to conceal its military might. Their report, which was released on Monday, said the conclusions are based on commercial satellite imagery, interviews with North Korean defectors, and with U.S. intelligence officials. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with one of the authors of that report. Joseph Bermudez is a senior fellow for imagery analysis at the Beyond Parallel program at CSIS in Washington.
I would say that North Korea's ballistic missile threat and its nuclear threat, which would use the ballistic missiles as delivery system, remains very significant and has not changed in the past 10 years.
So what did you find?
What we found were a network of missile operating bases located throughout North Korea. Some of these facilities have been mentioned directly or indirectly over the years, but very few, if any, have been specifically located. What we did was we went in, we identified these, we disambiguated a great deal of information. We validated other information and negated additional information to come up with our listing of sites, and we'll be publishing additional reports going forward.
Where do we go from here? I mean, what is this enough, do you think, for the U.S. to change its position?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. The people who are doing the actual talking, both, you know, face-to-face and back-channel, are really intelligent people. They have a plan. I'm not privy to that plan. However, I want to make sure that the public understands what's actually out there so they can inform their policymakers to inform those who are actually involved in the discussions. I think that's most important, that we have a base of information that is as valid as it can be at the unclassified level, so that the discussion can be informed, so we can move forward in a realistic manner.
Does this show some insufficiency as far as U.S. intelligence is concerned, that they haven't come up with it, or do you think they have and they just haven't told us about it?
I believe that the U.S. intelligence community, along with its allies, have a very good understanding of North Korea's ballistic missile forces and their disposition. I would say that they probably don't have a perfect understanding. And that's why I want to see a full and verifiable list produced by the North Koreans to move forward with. North Korea is an incredibly challenging target when it comes to intelligence collection. And North Korea has, since the late 60s at least, if not further back, pursued this deliberate policy of trying to conceal or deceive its capabilities with nuclear, chemical, biological, and ballistic missile capability. If we don't recognize that, and if we don't push hard on that, they're going to allow us to believe what we want to believe, or allow us to settle for something that is insufficient in the long run.
That's Joseph Bermudez, Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Strategy. At the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 100 years after fighting halted in the First World War, leaders from dozens of nations, the majority of countries that sent troops or workers to the Western Front, gathered over the weekend in France to remember the millions who died in the conflict. French President Emmanuel Macron, at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Paris, lit the eternal flame that's rekindled every night at the memorial. In his address, Macron spoke of the sacrifices of lives made a century ago in the 4 years of carnage in Europe. International Editions, we are talking with Catherine Field yesterday about the weekend's events.
One of the most important events was just north of Paris on Saturday, when the French President Emmanuel Macron stood arm in arm with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel on the same site where 100 years ago, to the day that armistice agreement was signed. Here were two old foes united for peace, Germany and France, two nations along with the rest of the world whose people, whose young men had exhausted themselves, killing one another. Suddenly were there, were together, and that was a very symbolic moment. I think the next big image that people will take away from Sunday, which was Armistice Day, was that picture of world leaders walking shoulder to shoulder up the Champs-Élysées in Paris towards the Arc de Triomphe in that symbolic show of unity. This idea that 100 years on, more than 70 heads of state and heads of international organizations get together one place and say, we know where the world went wrong, let's try and not make that mistake again.
There were, though, some things that stood out that were slightly on the controversial side or certainly raised some eyebrows. One of them, President Macron's speech, certainly seemed to be aimed quite a bit at the U.S. president.
Absolutely. Emmanuel Macron's speech was really one in which he warned against withdrawal, isolationism. He called isolationism a grave error, and it will be condemned by future generations. He talked about war being the result of collective failure, of nationalism being a betrayal. And it was really very closely and very, if you like, precisely aimed at Donald Trump and aimed at America. Because Emmanuel Macron, in his speech, he really did make disturbing parallels with the resurgence of nationalist tensions, which happened after the end of the First World War, and what's happening today. He also referred to that period at the end of the First World War when America disengaged from Europe after that crucial intervention on the side of the Allies in 1917 and through to the end of the First World War. After that, America withdrew. And Macron really did sort of point at that and say, look, we should be looking at the mistakes that were made in those inter-year wars. There is also this question of whether what happened at the end of the First World War is relevant today. And Emmanuel Macron said, yes, very much so, because the demons that were there that caused the First World War and caused the uncertainty after the end of the First World War, he said, are in a resurgence. They're resurfacing. And he said, this is there. It's in our communities and it's ready to wreak chaos and death. And he said, and I'm quoting here, history sometimes threatens to take its sinister course once again. And that is very clearly a message from Emmanuel Macron that the world's stability is threatened by nationalism and extremism.
What about the decision of President Trump not to go to the cemetery where thousands of U.S. soldiers from the war are buried?
Here in France, at least, it was seen as somewhat of a puzzling decision to not travel to the Belleau Wood Cemetery. The war was one of the key battles which stopped the Germans from getting to Paris at the end of the First World War, and that so many Marines died in that battle. And in fact, the history of that particular battle is really enshrined in Marine Corps history. So it was bemusement and a bit people scratching their heads, because we've seen in the last week the French President Emmanuel Macron make a big tour of these Eastern French cemeteries, these enormous cemeteries where thousands and thousands of men are buried. It's very much in people's minds that this was an area of France that right up until the last day of fighting, men were dying there. So it was seen as not so much as a snub, but it was really regarded as, well, we put this on for you, everybody's there, everybody's waiting, it's the right thing to do. So there was a lot of scratching of heads as to why, in the end, the American president did not travel to that cemetery.
That is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. The creator of Marvel Comics superheroes has died. Stan Lee, the creative dynamo who revolutionized the comic book and helped make billions for Hollywood by introducing human frailties in superheroes such as Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, and the Incredible Hulk, died on Monday. The AP's Ed Donahue has more.
Lee's comic book characters came to life on the big screen.
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. It's a minor masterpiece.
Stan Lee was the top writer at Marvel Comics and later as its publisher. He's widely considered the architect of the contemporary comic book. In a 2007 AP interview, Stan Lee says there's a bit of him in characters like the Hulk, Iron Man, and Spider-Man.
When you're writing the dialogue for a character, you have to imagine you're that character, or else how would you know what that character would say?
Stan Lee died in Los Angeles. He was 95. I'm Ed Donahue.
Listeners with an interest in science have likely seen at least one headline about a research paper proposing that the mysterious little space rock with a really funny name that zoomed between the Sun and Mercury last year might have alien origins. The research paper from Harvard University, one of the iviest of Ivy League schools, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, to be exact. So could it be that the object called Oumuamua, Hawaiian for scout, is truly some kind of alien artifact or an actual space probe sent to spy on us Earthlings? Joining us now is Greg Redfern, NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab Ambassador. Tell us what this is all about.
Last year, we had the first ever confirmed interstellar visitor to our solar system, and it was named Oumuamua, which means in Hawaiian, a distant messenger from far away. And astronomers thought maybe this was an asteroid, maybe it was a comet, but they weren't really sure. And what really perplexed everybody, Lori, is that when Oumuamua went around the sun, it did not display any typical things that a comet would do, like grow a tail, outgas material because of the heating up of the sun. And here is the biggest mystery of all. Oumuamua.
That's amazing and unbelievable if it turns out to be true. I'm part
well,
of all
the
this.
Most amazing thing about Oumuamua, this object from interstellar space, is that when it went around the sun and was headed out from our solar system, never to return again, it experienced slight increase in its acceleration speed. In other words, some non-gravitational force was causing it to speed up, and we have no idea what it was. So, these smart guys from Harvard published a paper in a very prestigious astronomical science journal that said, you know, Oumuamua displays properties that might be indicative of what we call a light sail. And humans, Lori, have built light sails, and they are large sails, just like sails on a ship at sea. These sails collect wind that comes out from the sun in the form of particles, and they thought maybe it could even be aliens directing this light sail to observe our solar system. Now, when Oumuamua came by the solar system, we bounced radar off of it. We set signals to it. We tried to listen for any kind of signal. But bottom line, astronomers don't know what this was.
All right, that's Greg Redfern, NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab ambassador. Well, the typical image of ballerinas is an agile dancers moving effortlessly across the stage on the tips of their toes with their feet bound in shiny pink slippers, which seem to be part of their bodies. Unless the ballerinas' bodies are not white. An American company began offering brown-toned slippers last year. And last month, Britain's oldest ballet apparel supplier began offering shoes made to better match the skin color of non-white dancers. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports on the changing trend.
Dancing in a ballet slipper that matches her skin is an incredible feeling, says Chira Robinson, a step into the right direction. She's been dancing since she was 8 years old.
I think it's amazing, especially because times are changing and, you know, there's so many different colors out there and ballet should be acceptable to everyone.
Made by Britain's oldest manufacturer, Freed of London, the new pointe shoes are available in bronze and brown along with the traditional pink.
When I received these amazing Freed pointe shoes called Ballet Bronze, I felt like I was really lucky because my first pointe shoes actually were super pink and super hard and everything, and it didn't match my skin color.
The 89-year-old ballet gear maker worked with the international dance company Ballet Black, whose dancers are all of Black and Asian descent, to create the new shoes. Marie-Astrid Mons is a junior artist who joined the company 4 years ago.
Finding your skin color in a ballet shop, it's something very special. You have the feeling you are part of the industry of dance, and you have the feeling that nothing is impossible because it's accessible and because your skin color is there.
Previously, dancers would have to perform a pancaking ritual by using foundation makeup or other paint types to darken the standard issue pink shoes.
Even though that's how I grew up, you know, not knocking tradition and everything like that, but times are changing and we need to see people who look like us. And in doing that, we need brown tights, brown shoes.
Dancing in shoes that fit their persona is no longer a dream. It's a reality that gives these ballerinas the feeling they are dancing on air. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for listening, and thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.